Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. But importantly, we will also discuss the times where science, or the people yielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host. While I'm not a forensic scientist, a psychologist, or a legal professional, I do look at these cases through a specific lens. I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My daily world is built on biology, chemistry, and the rigorous standards of lab science. But I've also always been driven by a deeper curiosity about psychology and sociology. Basically, humans fascinate me. I'm interested in the how and why of these crimes, and specifically, how scientific development, or the lack thereof, dictates the outcome of case. I know I'm just one of the many people interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I just look and think, science. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out there fascinated by the science behind these cases, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we're looking at a case that is often remembered for its cultural impact, but it is also a staggering example of what happens when scientific potential is ignored. In the 1981 disappearance of Adam Walsh, the failure wasn't necessarily in the science available at the time, but in the people who refused to use it. The departments that mishandled physical evidence and the old boys network that chose ego over investigative technique. This is a story of lost leads, destroyed forensics, and a 27-year quest to fix a broken investigation. Today, I will also be posting the first of a new category of episodes based on the failure of law enforcement and the ramifications of such. It isn't fair to discuss the advancements and triumphs of science without also discussing the times where it went tragically wrong. It is also important that we learn the lessons of these failed cases, such as today's of the murder of Adam Wall. This is a case that I relate to a lot, and that led to many advancements in criminal apprehension, even though Adam's killer was never convicted. I read a lot. That's probably obvious. I read fiction, nonfiction, scientific studies, even fan fiction. There is very little time in a day where I am not working or sleeping that I don't have a book or digital device in my hand. I can easily read 20 books in a weekend. As such, I do not leave reviews on everything I read. But when I read Bringing Adam Home, The Abduction That Changed America by Joe Matthews and Les Standiford in 2019, I had to leave a review on Amazon. That book has stuck with me. I noted that it was a disturbing read, but also a positive tale in the end. As a story that I was vaguely familiar with, mostly due to the aftermath, I'm also 6 months younger than Adam was or would have been in this story was an eye-opening read. The tragedy for the Walsh family is unmistakable, but it also highlighted to me how the very mishandling of this case led to such strides and changes in our society led by his father. I can't imagine it would never wish such tragedy and injustice on any family, but it is very easy to see the positive changes that resulted from it. I'm glad that the family did finally find closure. A lot of my information today will be based on that book. Today, I'll be talking about the background of this case and society then and now. This case is one of the failures of law enforcement, but also about Adam's amazing family and his legacy in the aftermath of this case. There's a recurring joke on the internet about how much freedom Generation X had as children, and that we were told to go out and play and not return before the streetlights came on. This is reflected in the media of the time, such as the movie Stand By Me, where four boys set out on a journey to find a dead body of a missing boy that they heard about, from an older sibling talking. Hey, us Gen Xers love our pop culture references. And there was a lot of media directed solely to us and the activities we have occupied our time with. Also, a lot of us are more than a little morbid. The world was beginning to change, but it wasn't quite there yet. This was before the time of Amber Alerts on every cell phone and electronic road sign, even before children on milk cartons. Serial killers were just becoming part of the collective consciousness. It was barely 12 years after Charles Manson and his family and the Tate-LaBianca murders. It was 4 years after David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, had terrorized New York City. It was approximately 2 years since Ted Bundy has stood trial barely 30 minutes away from where Adam and his family lived. It was less than a year since John Lennon had been assassinated, a few months since the attempted assassination of the U.S. President Ronald Reagan. These events were shown each night on primetime news, which Americans still sat down nightly to watch. But those crimes were out there somewhere. They weren't part of their daily lives. They were almost as theatrical to the average person as, "Who shot JR?" In this world, it was not unusual for parents to not have their eyes on their kids at all times, even one as young as Adam was. He was 6 years old. It was the summer of 1981. His mother was shopping at the mall in Sears, a big department store, and left Adam by a display of video games that would occupy his attention and ostensibly keep him out of trouble while she completed her errand. There were some older boys there playing with the video game console, and they began to tussle over it, probably getting a little rowdy, as young boys can while playing video games. Due to this disturbance, a security guard on duty ordered all of the boys out of the store, including little Adam, who wasn't part of the group. They weren't sent to the interior part of the mall, but out of the store, into the parking lot. Since Adam wasn't part of this group, when they left, he was alone. A 6-year-old child, in the parking lot, not knowing where to go or what to do. When his mother returned to get him a short while later, he was nowhere to be found. His mother looked around, but she was unable to locate him. She asked the associates for help looking, thinking he just wandered off. Maybe something else had caught his attention. She had him paged overhead, the kind of, "Adam, please come to the courtesy desk. Your mom is looking for you." There was no response. She ran into Adam's grandmother, who happened to also be in the store, and she helped her look. They had no luck. After 90 minutes, they called the police. I can't imagine how frantic she must have felt. She was probably sure he would show up any minute and invalidate her panic, but still thinking the worst. At this age, I was wandering around the neighborhood, having dinner at friends' houses, playing in the church my grandmother worked at, always wandering away. I know I drove my mom a little crazy. I'm sure in that moment of panic, Reve Walsh felt that this would all blow over, that she was just being crazy, but her baby was missing. Right then, she didn't know that she would never see him again. 14 days. That's how long her uncertainty lasted. 14 days where she didn't know where her baby was because she took her eyes off him for just a second. 14 days that she prayed her baby would just come home and tell her about his adventure. 14 days where Adam's parents went on television and offered a reward for his safe return. But it wasn't to be. On August 10th, a severed head was found in a drainage canal over 2 hours away from that mall where Adam was last seen. The coroner determined that Adam died of asphyxiation, but the rest of his body was never found. Initially, the police looked closely at the family and acquaintances of the Walsh family. Despite the later commonly pushed public rhetoric of stranger danger, it has always been true that the greatest risk for the abuse or death of a child comes from family and acquaintances of that child. There are about 100 children each year that are taken by stranger abduction out of about 750 to 800,000 children reported missing within the US each year. It was unthinkable to the average parent. Sure, it happened, but to someone else's kid in someone else's neighborhood, it was barely real until it happened in a way that couldn't be ignored. Less than a week after Adam's disappearance, the captain of the Hollywood Detectives, Steve Davis, made a call to the Miami Beach Police Department asking for their assistance. Despite the 25 officers in his department that were working on this case full time for 4 days now, they had no leads, no evidence, and no idea how to proceed. Matthews had been one of Davis's mentors and was considered one of the best. Matthews also had young children of his own and possessed a dedication to his career that made him eager to help. What Joe didn't know at that time was that he would spend the next 27 years trying to fix what was broken in those first few days. This is where I think that everything really begins to fall apart, and the police truly fail in their investigation. Not because of Matthews, certainly, but because despite having no experience with this type of investigation, no clues about how to proceed, they refuse to listen to the outsider and refuse to utilize the expertise he was offering. While the search for Adam's killer was just beginning for the public, behind the scenes, the battle of egos was already sabotaging the case. Matthews had noted immediately that it wasn't that the officers were not invested in their work, but that it was chaotic, unfocused. They seemed to assume that the case would resolve itself. They didn't want to be told how to do their jobs. As Matthew describes the main investigator, Detective Hoffman, and his boss, Chief Hessler, in his book, Bringing Adam Home, they made me so angry. Appearing as stereotypical old boys network cops, more concerned with appearances and credit than in solving the death of a little boy. In 1981, police intelligence was an island. The Hollywood Police Department's decision to keep the case close to the vest wasn't just about strategy, it was about turf. This compartmentalization meant that neighboring departments were left in the dark, unable to connect similar attempted abductions that might have led straight to the killer. It was the same systemic arrogance that allowed predators like the Golden State Killer to evade justice for decades. A world where a badge stopped at the city line and a killer simply drove across it. The Old Boys Network didn't just create a barrier for outside detectives like Matthews, it also created a graveyard for physical evidence. Because the department was so focused on controlling the narrative and protecting their turf, the basic tenets of forensics and chain of custody often fell by the wayside. Communication was nearly non-existent. Tips would come in and be jotted down on a spare piece of paper by a detective who then moved on to another case. A suspect who was scheduled for a lie detector test with Matthews, procedure where they had to be relatively comfortable and at ease, was instead hauled into an intensive interrogation. It wasn't just a lack of communication that stalled the case. The very clues that could have ended the Walsh family's nightmare were being mishandled, misplaced, or entirely ignored in the chaos of a department that was in over its head. For 2 years, the case went cold, frozen by the very bureaucracy that was supposed to protect the evidence. It stayed that way until October 1983, when a name emerged from a prison cell in northern Florida, a name that should have ended the nightmare right then and there: Otis Toole. While in prison for other crimes, Otis Toole confessed to the murder. He gave a very detailed account of the murder to detectives from northern Florida, a completely different jurisdiction where they didn't even know about the Adam Walsh case. Now, he did lie in part of his initial confession, trying to rope in Henry Lee Locus, his former partner, to the crime. However, when the detectives from Hollywood were finally called in, they displayed a staggering lack of interest. They weren't just skeptical of Toole, they seemed resentful of a lead they hadn't discovered themselves. Rather than doing the hard work of separating Toole's lies from his facts, they used his history of deception as an excuse to walk away from the most significant breakthrough in the case. They expended the expected effort in locating the Cadillac he claimed to be driving at the time of the murder. It was located and seized, and investigators at the time noticed there were blood stains on the floorboards of the vehicle, and even found a machete that Toole claimed was the murder weapon. However, when they couldn't immediately prove the blood was Adam's, using the limited blood typing tech of the early 80s, they essentially gave up on the vehicle, deciding it was just Toole telling a story. Then, in a move that still baffles legal experts today, the Hollywood Police Department released the car back to the scrapyard just days after seizing it. They didn't just lose the evidence, they intentionally let it go. The car was crushed and sold for scrap, and the machete vanished shortly thereafter. With the Cadillac crushed and the machete gone, the Hollywood Police Department effectively buried the investigation alongside the evidence. For the next 2 decades, the case languished in a state of official paralysis. John and Reve Walsh were forced to channel their grief into a public crusade for other children, even as their own son's file gathered dust in a department that seemed content to let it remain a mystery. In 2006, when the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act was introduced, an act that created the U.S. National Sex Offender Registry, John Walsh was on Capitol Hill to support it. During a press conference, a reporter asked him if, despite all the work that he had done for other families, for children everywhere, if he was bothered that he had no answers about his own son. It was incredibly tactless and insensitive, but it did strike a nerve. Sensing that the window for justice was closing, John and Reve decided to put one last ditch effort into their son's case. They needed and deserved answers. John turned to the one man who had seen the truth through the chaos 25 years earlier. Detective Joe Matthews had been involved in the investigation of Adam's disappearance from the beginning. He was also a long-term acquaintance of the family and had worked with John on America's Most Wanted for years. He had also worked over the years to bring evidence forward and point out mistakes that had been made in Adam's case. The Walshes asked him to make one final exhaustive push to go back through all of the evidence, the theories, to bring fresh eyes one last time, as if it were a cold case featured on their show. They asked him to rebuild a case from the ghosts of the evidence the Hollywood PD had thrown away. Joe Matthews was determined to do right by John and Revet, but most importantly, Adam. This was the case that he hadn't let go of, and he was going to do everything he could to give the Walshes some sort of closure. In the early desperation of the investigation, everyone, even family and friends, were under a microscope. John himself was questioned extensively. The first main suspect of the Hollywood Police Department was Jimmy Campbell. Jimmy was a friend of the Walsh family who lived with them for a time. Initially, the police focused entirely on Jimmy Campbell, a family friend who had been living with the Walshes, under the speculative theory that he and Revet were having an affair. Despite a total lack of evidence, Hoffman and Hessler spent critical days trying to prove that this convenient narrative was the truth. This focus didn't just insult the grieving parents, it allowed the real killer to remain effectively off the radar. How many times have we seen it? The convenient scapegoat, the easy suspect. It doesn't matter what evidence does or doesn't exist, what alibi a suspect has. Some people are convinced that they know better. They know the truth. However, whatever some of the police wanted to believe, Jimmy had not abducted and killed Adam. Whoever did was getting further and further from their grasp. In recent years, many have pointed to the possibility that Adam crossed paths with Jeffrey Dahmer. Because the official investigation was such a mess, it left a vacuum. And in true crime, a vacuum is always filled by theories. Perhaps the most chilling what if involves a man whose name wouldn't be known to the world for another decade and was living just miles away at the time of Adam's disappearance. In 1981, Jeffrey Dahmer was an unknown entity living in South Beach, Miami after being discharged from the Army. He was working as a gourmet cook at the Sunshine Inn and lived just a short drive from the Hollywood Mall. Two different witnesses later identified Dahmer from photos as a man they saw at the Hollywood Mall on July 27, 1981. One witness claimed to have seen him hovering near the toy department. Another claimed to see him throwing a struggling child into a blue van or car. While Dahmer owned a blue 1971 Pontiac Le Mans at the time, he also had access to a van through his work. On the day Adam disappeared, multiple people reported a blue van with no hubcaps and a radio antenna on the back, driving erratically near the mall. There had also been possible reports of a child being abducted in a blue van. However, Dahmer was known for being candid, and even boastful, about his crimes once captured. He admitted to 17 murders, but consistently denied killing Adam Walsh. And Adam doesn't fit his preferred target of older teens and young men. At the same time, killing a young child, such as Adam, carries a different social stigma, even within prison. But while the Dahmer theory offers a terrifying Hollywood ending to the mystery, the evidence on the ground pointed towards a much more squalid, chaotic reality. The vacuum of the investigation doesn't need a high-profile monster to explain it. It just needs the man who is already sitting in a prison cell, waiting for someone to listen. Otis Toole was uneducated. He definitely had mental health challenges, but he wasn't stupid. He was a career criminal and had a habit of falsely confessing to crimes. I think his overwhelming motivation was in receiving attention. To Tool, a murder was a bargaining chip for a pack of cigarettes or a day out of his cell. The more things he confessed to, the more attention police paid to him, the more they talked to him. He then would take the information that they inadvertently fed to him with their questions and use it to bolster his confessions. Later, when he was no longer getting his fix and was facing consequences, he would then recant his confessions. Tool and his partner Lucas were the confession kings of the 80s, often treating murder admissions like trading cards for perks in prison. Tool was also currently mad at Lucas for running off and abandoning him, so by including him in the confession of the crime, he was putting him on the hook, so to speak. However, Lucas had the perfect alibi, having been in jail, proving that Tool was at least partially lying. This gave the Hollywood PD the perfect out. They could dismiss Tool's words as just another tall tale from a pathological liar, ignoring the details that only a killer would know. However, his initial confession to Adam's death was unprompted and seemed to weigh on his conscience, even if he occasionally changed certain details to suit himself. Tool described driving out north on I-95, Adam panicking, and the eventual murder and decapitation using a machete. Investigators noted that some of his descriptions matched details of the crime that had not been made public. When the Cadillac that Tool owned and was driving at the time of the murder was impounded, police found blood-stained carpet inside. They also found a machete, which Tool claimed to have been used to behead Adam, and that aligned with the nature of the remains found in the Vero Beach Canal. Tool's niece later told John Walsh that Tool had confessed to the murder one final time on his deathbed before passing away in 1996. Otis Tool was presumed guilty due to the knowledge of specific details of the crime, despite his many recantations, and that was enough to provide the Walsh family with the legal closure they had sought for 27 years. However, Tool and his partner Lucas had a habit of confessing to crimes that they did not commit. There could have been another party out there that was involved in Adam's kidnapping and murder. It's a haunting thought. In a world where investigators were so focused on their own egos and turf wars, is it possible that they didn't just miss Dahmer, but someone else entirely? Someone whose name we've never even heard. In the end, the Hollywood PD settled for Tool to give the Walshes closure, but in the shadows of this case, a small, cold doubt remains. It is unlikely, but not impossible. If so, they got away with a horrific crime. As I stated in the beginning, this was the end of a sort of innocence for the general public. This case and the subsequent publicity sparked a whole atmosphere of stranger danger. It was thought that children would just be snatched up off the street willy-nilly by predators and other people with bad intentions if they were left unsupervised. Inflated statistics were reported by the media, and by 1985, missing children were portrayed on milk cartons. In 1996, the Amber Alert program began. This eventually became the organized system we use today, displaying alerts on digital highway signs, text messages to cell phone users, and media emergency broadcasts. However, a lot of these forward actions are grounded in the legacy of one child, one family that paid an unthinkable cost for our awareness. That child was 6-year-old Adam Walsh, who disappeared from this world on July 27, 1981. The National Amber Alert Program of 2003 was one of the results of the Walsh's work. They started with the passage of the 1982 Missing Children Act, which allows the FBI to enter missing children into the national database. Then they helped with the establishment of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in 1984, and eventually they championed and helped to nationalize the Amber Alert program, named after Amber Hagerman. Finally, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act that created the National Sex Offender Registry was signed into law on July 27, 2006, 25 years after Adam's death. John Walsh viewed this bill as the capstone of a life's work, a mission to remove the bureaucratic hurdles that once hindered the recovery of missing children. While Adam's story began with a terrifying void in a Florida parking lot, it ended by creating a safety net that has since protected millions. For the Walshes, the cost was unthinkable, but the legacy is a world that no longer looks away. There are no words to describe how overwhelmingly sad this case is. A young boy was lost, and a family was devastated. Her whole society was changed. In 2008, the Hollywood Police Department finally held a press conference that provided the formal closure the Walshes had fought for. They officially named Otis Toole as Adam's killer. Toole, a convicted serial killer who had confessed and recanted multiple times before his death in prison in 1996, was the man Matthews had been pointing toward all along. The department's chief at the time, Chadwick Wagner, did something his predecessors had refused to do. He apologized. He admitted that the original investigation was flawed and the evidence, which Joe Matthews had meticulously re-examined, had been there for decades. Toole will never be prosecuted for the crime. The Walshes can have the satisfaction that the case was solved and that Toole is no longer part of this world, but he will never be held accountable for Adam's death or the grief of parents who were forced to go on without their firstborn child. This case is a haunting reminder of what happens when evidence is mishandled. Next time on The Science of Murder, we're bringing back into the lab to look at one of the most visual disciplines in forensics, bloodstain pattern analysis. We'll discuss the physics behind the droplets, the stories they tell at a crime scene, and the fine line between scientific fact and expert interpretation. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast to continue learning along with me. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider, and encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear from you on social media or email about this topic or any future ones you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me at scienceofmurder@gmail.com.